Our next speaker is Dennis Rooney. Mr. Rooney joined ARSC in 1996 and has been a regular presenter at these conferences. He's a member of the Technical Committee and Book Awards panel. His review of books and recordings regularly appear in the ARSC Journal. A professional career embracing classical record production, journalism, broadcasting, and narration has been accompanied by nearly six decades as a record collector. Discs from his collection are frequently used in CD historical reissues. As both a producer and archival and catalog exploitation consultant to the classical recording industry, Mr. Rooney's developed and contributed to important classical reissue lines for Sony Classical, including the award-winning Masterworks Heritage Historical Reissues. Thank you very much. Universal Classics, where in 2006 he planned and produced the 10-CD set Steinway Legends in cooperation with Steinway & Sons and Vox. He also conceived and produced a 12-CD set of historical broadcast recordings by the Minnesota Orchestra, issued to celebrate its 2003 centennial. His presentation is Serge Koussevitzky and the Boston Symphony Orchestra, 1928 to 1929, a recorded legacy. Mr. Rooney.
To join us this afternoon. And I'll have the first cut, please. Boston Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Serge Koussevitzky, in full cry in that bit from the finale of Tchaikovsky's Fourth Symphony, recorded in Symphony Hall by Victor in 1936. In his 25 years at the helm in Boston, Koussevitzky recorded between 1928 and 1951. I'm using a lav, am I not? It's not working. Okay, I guess I'm using this. It's a rich legacy, documenting his artistic accomplishments as an interpreter and reflecting his tireless advocacy of living composers and fostering nearly an entire generation of American composers. Yes, it's a rich legacy, but I'm afraid all I can offer you this afternoon in the time allotted me is an amuse-gueule, a mere flavor of the superb performances preserved on those 78 RPM matrices and early tape recordings. If Arturo Toscanini forsook the cello for the podium, Kuzovitsky was already a famous virtuoso player of the double bass before he decided on a conducting career. He was born to a poor Jewish family in the small Russian village of Vyshny Volochok, about 160 miles northwest of Moscow, on the 26th of July, 1874. His father played either violin or double bass, possibly both. His mother was a pianist, and one of his siblings, Adolf, was a well-known teacher, conductor in Moscow. At 17, Kuzovitsky applied for admission at the school of the Moscow Philharmonic Society, since the penniless youth could not afford the tuition. He was given the choice to study either trombone or double bass, both of which came with a scholarship and a stipend, since students seldom chose them. Kuzovitsky opted for the double bass. Within a year, he had progressed so rapidly that his teacher, Rambushek, declared him a virtuoso. He played with Tchaikovsky in the composer's home. His first solo performance was in 1896 in Moscow. He also performed in chamber groups, either in trios or quartets. In 1901, he became the principal of the Bolshoi Orchestra bass section and began teaching double bass at his alma mater. He began to concertize throughout Europe. His very last double bass recital took place after he arrived in the United States, in Carnegie Hall in 1928. The next year, Victor recorded him in a group of bass solos. Here's a portion of his transcription of a sonata by Henry Eccles. The pianist is Pierre Lubischutz. That gives you some idea of the extraordinary reputation he possessed, and also, to some extent, where the foundation of his orchestral bass sound came from. It is waggishly reported that someone attended that recital and came home, told his wife in stupefaction, "It was the most amazing instrumental performance I've ever heard. It sounded like a lousy cello." Kuzovitsky continued to concertize on the bass and enlarged his European reputation. In 1905, he married Natalia Ushkov, the daughter of a wealthy tea merchant. It was his second marriage, and thereafter his musical ambition would be realized with the aid of Natalia and her family fortune. First, the couple moved to Berlin, where Kuzovitsky decided to become a conductor. He watched some of the great podium figures of the day, particularly Artur Nikisch and Gustav Mahler. And although he never studied with Nikisch, they obviously established some kind of relationship because Kuzovitsky paid off Nikisch's gambling debts. In any event, Kuzovitsky hired the Berlin Philharmonic to play in Beethoven Hall in Berlin in 1908 and doing an all-Russian program that was quite well received by the critics, and this encouraged him to continue. That next year, he and his wife established L'Edition Russe de Musique, the Russian music house, which began to publish modern Russian composers. They went back to Russia in 1910. Kuzovitsky had a grandiose idea of bringing music to the people and took his hired orchestra on a steam barge down the Volga all the way to Odessa and back again. And these became a feature of summertime musical life in Russia right up until World War I. He stayed in Russia during the war and after the Soviet triumph in 1917, temporarily had a post, but with the expropriation of the Ushkov fortune, at least the part of it that remained in Russia, and his resistance to the strictures of the Soviet state regarding musicians and performances, the couple finally left and settled in Paris, where he continued his conducting career and established the Concert Koussevitzky. In 1922, he commissioned Maurice Ravel to orchestrate Mussorgsky's pictures in an exhibition. And this kind of work, as well as presenting the music of Prokofiev to the West, began to attract international attention, particularly American. And in 1924, he came to the United States, succeeding Pierre Monteux as conductor of the Boston Symphony Orchestra. We're going to hear one of his earlier recordings in which he presents a Prokofiev work for the first time on records. Beginning of Prokofiev's Classical Symphony in its premiere recording made in April of 1929. That was 1 year after Koussevitzky began his Boston Symphony discography. Between 1924 and 1928, he made no recordings. He didn't feel that the orchestra was ready. And one of the things that perhaps took them a while to get accustomed was Koussevitzky's idiosyncratic way of working. He was a great instrumentalist, but he was no theoretician. He couldn't even read a score. What he had to do in order to learn to conduct the repertoire that he chose was to engage a pianist who would respond to him as he stood on a podium in his home and getting comfortable with the lineaments of the scores. And so many times he conducted from memory. But in any event, how he achieved his results was through fairly endless rehearsal, which he was able to do since the Boston Symphony was the only major American orchestra that was non-union and remained non-union until sometime during World War II. So the brilliance and the achievement that he was able to work out in Boston was the product of endless rehearsal and repetition until the orchestra got it right. It paid off without any doubt, as we will hear right now.
Thank you.
the finale of Haydn's Symphony No. 102, an example of one of the standard scores that Kuzovitsky brought to a high virtuosic polish. And here's another one, the portion of the minuet of the Will-o'-the-Wisps from Berlioz's La Damnation de Faust. Sorry, I had no idea there was this much lag between cue and appearance. I don't suppose anyone needs to be told that Kuzovitsky was a great champion of modern music. Over 128 new works were performed when he was conductor of the Boston Symphony. For the orchestra's 50th anniversary in 1931, he commissioned such enduring works as Ravel's Piano Concerto in G, Gershwin's Second Rhapsody, Prokofiev's Symphony No. 4, which the composer later revised, Hindemith's Concert Music for Strings and Brass, and Stravinsky's Symphony of Psalms. I love the dedication of that work. Stravinsky writes, "To the glory of God and the Boston Symphony Orchestra." That same year, he recorded his commission in 1922 from Ravel of Pictures at an Exhibition, actually a few months before 1931. And this recording continued to remain in the Victor catalog until practically the end of Kuzovitsky's life. We're just going to hear a tiny little bit of it. This is Two Polish Jews, One Rich, One Poor, also known as Samuel Goldenberg and Schmoyle. Started from the beginning, possibly. Okay, you're going to get a much shorter excerpt than I had originally planned on. In 1936, Kuzovitsky became involved in the Berkshire Music Festival, which had been going on at Tanglewood up near Lenox, Massachusetts. It was started by a rich New Yorker who hired the New York Philharmonic under Henry Hadley at the beginning, but eventually the Boston Symphony took over and Kuzovitsky began to involve himself in Tanglewood to a great extent. And perhaps his most enduring contribution was to establish the Tanglewood School, where young composers and conductors could be taught. He fostered a whole generation of composers, one of whom, and perhaps the most remarkable individual in the group, was Aaron Copland. If the communication gods smile on us, I'm going to try and present a little bit of El Salón México, which was given its premiere recording in December of 1938. It's just a bit of the end. I don't know exactly what we're going to get, But what's wonderful about this recording, it's as deliciously rowdy seven decades on as it was the day it first came off the press. Gentlemen. Every American composer was as felicitously favored as Copland was by Koussevitzky. There's the famous story of the young American composer who comes up to him after a concert indignant and says, "Maestro, why haven't you performed my new symphony?" Koussevitzky looks at him impassively. "But Maestro, you promised." Koussevitzky turns that slightly basilisk stare on him and says, "My dear, I make many promises, but God gives me the strength not to keep all of them." In addition to the composers fostered, his most famous conducting student and protege was unquestionably Leonard Bernstein. When Bernstein got a pair of cufflinks from Koussevitzky as a gift, he wore them at every concert he conducted for the rest of his life. When Natalia died in 1942, Koussevitzky established the Koussevitzky Music Foundation in her honor. Its purpose was to pay for the composition and performance of selected works. And it's had a remarkable track record. At the very beginning of its existence, it was responsible for such things as Britten's Peter Grimes, Douglas Moore's The Ballad of Baby Doe, and Bartók's Concerto for Orchestra, which was a way of supporting Bartók when he was desperately ill. Fritz Reiner and Koussevitzky cooked up this support scheme, and of course Bartók bristled, being the highly principled man he was, but the work got written, and Koussevitzky performed it in a somewhat different form than we hear today. He continued to record for Victor right up until 1950, after his retirement in 1949. He went from portable machines in Symphony Hall to the last sessions in November 1950 on magnetic tape using RCA's proprietary RT2 quarter-inch machines at 30 inches per second. Those were Sibelius's Second Symphony and Grieg's The Last Spring. But I'm going to finish with a performance of another Sibelius symphony. Koussevitzky was a remarkable Sibelian. He's one of the composer's greatest champions at a time when Sibelius's works became very, very popular. He recorded the Second and the Fifth Symphonies for Victor. He also had done a live recording of the Seventh Symphony in London, which was released on records as well. What we're going to hear is the First Symphony, just the very end of it. This is from a 1945 performance in Boston that was recorded by ABC Radio and preserved on lacquer discs and tightly controlled, they would like to believe, by the Boston Symphony Transcription Trust. They hold on to a whole group of Koussevitzky performance recordings that are known to continue to exist in reasonably good estate. They hold on to them a bit like Fafner in Das Rheingold, or not Das Rheingold, but in Siegfried. But in any event, occasionally things leak out, and this Sibelius Symphony was one of the leakers. And here's just a bit of the end of it, just to suggest the sweep, the majesty, the passion that Koussevitzky brought to all his performances of Sibelius. That's Kuzovitsky cutting a birthday cake shortly before his death on June 4th, 1951. Within 5 years of his death, his recorded legacy was virtually totally unavailable and has remained largely unavailable ever since. Victor has had RCA Victor in all of its later incarnations, has had a very cavalier attitude towards the importance of this catalog. I have been lucky. Over six decades of collecting, I've acquired all of the Kuzovitsky recordings in one guise or another, and the intense pleasure derived from handling them, from putting them on a turntable, from hearing the sound leap from the grooves without any mediation. These are things that only come to collectors. And I hope that some of you listening have an interest in digging deeper, because that's only the only way you're going to find out more about Serge Kuzovitsky. It was a fascinating career. It was a fascinating impact on American music. There he is with Münch on the right and Monteur on the left, his predecessor and successor. And there he is finally. I can't really say any more about him, except I hope you've enjoyed this all too brief exposition of some of his recordings. Any questions? Save them to the end of the segment. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Thank you for the Sibelius.